Funding for this talk comes from TrialX, connecting patients to clinical trials.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the CurePanel talk show on mental health. I'm Priya Menon, scientific media editor at CureTalk. And along with the CureTalk team of Sharif Khan and Chintan Patel, I welcome all of you this evening to a discussion on mental health. As always, we will be moderating the call and bringing people live on the show. As most people here know, CurePanel talk show is organized by CureTalk, the blog of TrialX.com, an online platform to connect patients to clinical trials of new treatments. For information on clinical trials for all conditions, please visit trialx.com/ask. CurePanel talk show started its journey with discussions on multiple myeloma, and we are happy to say that we have grown and now conduct panel discussions on myeloma, prostate cancer, and yoga too. Our broadcasts have been replayed almost 40,000 times. This is the 11th episode of CurePanel talk show, and the first time we're discussing mental health on this platform. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and we are excited and honored to welcome renowned researcher and clinical psychologist Dr. Kamran Falapur, Director of Brain Resource Center, as an expert speaker on today's CurePanel talk show. Welcome to the show, Dr. Falapur. Dr. Kamran Falapur's clinical practice and research activities are focused on health psychology, applied neuroscience, and computer-human interface. Dr. Falapur has years of experience in assessment and treatment of various psychological and neuropsychological conditions. Dr. Falapur's current research includes participation in development of one of the largest databases of brain, cognitive, and genomic data across mental disorders. Today's show is co-hosted by blogger and schizoaffective disorder survivor, Jennifer Myers. Jennifer was diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder in 2002. She's currently working on her memoir and enjoys photography, Buddhist chanting, and exercise. We also have Jennifer Robinson on the panel, who is a mental health advocate who lives with schizoaffective disorder. Jennifer is on the board of directors for National Alliance on Mental Illness, Pinellas County. She's part of crisis intervention team training for law enforcement officers in Pinellas. We also have Erin King-Reed, who is a bipolar disorder 2 and borderline personality disorder survivor. Erin is currently working on her second MA in English. Before I hand over to Jennifer Myers, I would also like to read out a couple of rules. If you're listening into the panel through your phone as well as a computer, please mute or stop the online broadcast on your computer for better audio quality. Callers will be invited to ask questions at the end of the discussion. They can let us know by pressing 1 on their keypads, and we will bring them online live. Jennifer would now introduce us to the topic of discussion. Jennifer, you're on air.
Okay, thank you, Priya. Thank you for joining us. Tonight's discussion topic is the latest treatments under research for mental health disorders. Dr. Falapur's type of research is moving the field of psychiatry toward diagnoses rooted in neuroscience rather than symptoms. This also includes a new National Institute of Mental Health project called the Research Domain Criteria that's creating a new classification system for mental illnesses based partly on genetics. This new system is a step toward precision medicine that's transformed cancer diagnosis and treatment. There's also a recent study in February which found that having a few key genes can raise the probability of an individual developing any one of the following mental illnesses, including schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, ADHD, depression, and autism. So while it's critically important to understand what's happening in a person's brain who suffers from mental disorders or mental illness, I believe that we should always keep in mind the human, social, and emotional component of these types of mental illnesses. I think helping people manage a mental health disorder is more than just understanding what went wrong in their brains. And so to speak further on the topic, I would like to invite Dr. Falapur to discuss the type of work and research that he's currently working on. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for that introduction and for the information you gave. So I will perhaps start with saying a little bit about some of the research we've been involved with and how some of the findings from this type of research can be actually applied to, you know, helping patients today. So as you all know, there is a pretty exciting movement in the field of psychiatry, psychology, in terms of using neuroscience and what we call evidence-based treatment, which involves really assessment, which is underutilized in psychiatry, in my opinion, and the opinion of many other experts. And it also involves evidence-based kind of interventions that really focus on what is, you know, the underlying or what are the underlying issues in the brain that relates to that specific disorder. So as you probably know, for the most part of, you know, psychiatry these days, what happens is that if you go to a professional and you are asking for some kind of help with medication, for instance, there is very limited amount of testing that is being done before medication is prescribed. In other words, for the most part these days, prescription of psychiatric medication is based on trial and error. Of course, you know, there is something called clinical wisdom and experience, and there are certain, you know, information and experience that various practitioners have, and that experience is obviously used in making clinical judgments. But again, going back to objective measures, there has been very little that has been done in the field of psychiatry in terms of prescribing medication or even other treatments based on objective findings that are rooted in the brain or are rooted based on or are basically discovered based on some objective testing. So some of the research we've been involved with in the past 10 years or so that came through a consortium of neuroscientists that started from University of Sydney, the Brain Resource, and then later on moved to become, you know, this database that was put together, was really keying in on the idea that, you know, all these psychiatric disorders or neurological disorders have their roots in the brain and, of course, in genes as well. And what would happen if we actually created a database of normative information on the brain? So, for example, have hundreds and thousands of individuals who are tested, and when I say tested, these tests comprise of looking at electrical activity in the brain, electroencephalography, looking at information processing in the brain, looking at the way that person, that individual is performing cognitively in terms of attention, focus, in terms of memory, we're looking at auditory, visual, basically various cognitive domains that are, again, rooted in the activities in the brain. And if we take that information and we have the norms, and then we take each patient population, let's say someone with bipolar disorder or someone with depression or someone with ADD, ADHD, or someone with brain injury, and then we compare to that normative database, what do we find, and how is that finding helpful in terms of not only diagnosis, but also in terms of what are the treatment options, and how can it help tailor that treatment? So that was done. The normative database was created, and basically, you know, the information that was the normative database, but from the norms, was including brain activity, as I mentioned, cognitive profile, some genetic data, some, you know, history and background in terms of, from sleep disorders to, various childhood stressors, and basically many, many scales that are commonly used in psychiatric research were included in this domain. Then to take one step further, we started doing a couple of different projects with that or research studies that look at, for instance, in depression, doing pre-post testing in terms of, let's say you take a cohort of individuals who have depression, and let's say you assign them to one of the few major kind of antidepressant medications that are commonly prescribed. And then, taking that information, which again is information on the brain and brain functions, but also cognitive data and genetic data, et cetera, and then randomly assign different treatments. In other words, let's say someone takes Zoloft, someone takes Effexor, someone else is randomly, again, assigned all of this, is taking Lexapro, for instance. And then let's look at how these people improve over several weeks. And then let's go back and retest them. And then let's look and see which profile actually improved, which medication, and who actually developed side effects. And with all that information, then in the future, we will be able to actually predict treatment response before giving the medication, which I think is key. And I think that this type of research, and I'm not suggesting that our group was the only group. I think there are other groups around the world who are looking at similar kind of logic. But this mindset about how to do objective testing to predict medication response, I think, is very crucial and something that is finally happening. And I think in the years to come, we will see the outcome of this type of research and how it can actually help people with getting the right medication without having to go through years of agony with, you know, side effects and so forth. So that's one aspect of it. But it has also, this type of research has also given us opportunity to also test other modalities and other ways of treating patients with various disorders, which is another subject which I will get into in a moment. But I wanted to get some feedback or questions about this part before I move forward with the other section. So are there any questions or any feedback that at this point you want to discuss?
Well, I guess I could ask my first question in terms of the database that you are developing. Is it similar to the project created by the National Institute of Mental Health? That's trying to create a different classification system for mental illnesses that's based on the brain instead of symptoms. Is that related to your work?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I just wanted to mention that I'm not the only one. This work has been done by a consortium of various neuroscientists around the world. But the answer to your question is that there are parallels, but they're not exactly the same. In other words, these types of physiological and kind of neural-based testing that we're doing are not exactly what they're doing, but there are common elements. So, for example, our focus has been brain functions, electrical activity in the brain, how the brain processes information, how some parts of the brain are overactive or underactive with each disorder. For example, with ADD, ADHD, oftentimes we have the prefrontal lobe having more slow activity, or what we call hypofrontality. There are, you know, with depression, there is another signature. There might be some left prefrontal or frontal lobe underactivation, or various other, and, you know, of course, each disorder has subtypes in terms of that. But it's a little bit, I think, different, although there are common aspects to them. For example, we have explored genetics to some extent, but it's not all focused on genes. And it's our the database that we've been involved in creating focuses more on psychophysiology, on electrical activity in the brain, on psychometrics, meaning the cognitive kind of domains of, you know, attention, memory, and various other cognitive skills, and so forth. But there are common threads there, but they're not exactly the same. I hope that answers your question.
Oh, yes, definitely. Thank you, Dr. Falapur.
Sure.
Jennifer Robinson, would you like to ask a question?
Yes, I was curious if you found, with this research, any connections genetically between different mental illnesses. For example, in my family, there are a few people that have diagnosed with bipolar disorder, but I have schizoaffective disorder. And I was wondering if you ever find that different mental illnesses occur in the same family?
Right, that's a very good question. Although genetics is not my domain of expertise, but I can tell you, and the results of genetic testing that we've done and research we've done is still being kind of, the data is being mined, and we haven't really published those yet. I will just answer your question based on my clinical observation and my own experience, because I've seen hundreds and hundreds of patients in my practice and in the research we've done. And one of the very basic questions and common questions we ask every patient who comes in for an assessment or treatment is that, is there any other psychiatric disorder in your family on either side of the family? And oftentimes the answer is yes. And it's not always going to be exactly the same disorder, although it can be, but it could be another variation, or it could be another disorder that somehow shares some common symptoms in it. So, for instance, I might have someone who comes in with OCD, and then when I explore, you know, maybe their parents or siblings or, you know, on either side of the family, maybe there is no OCD, but there is a history of anxiety in the family, or there's a history of another psychiatric disorder in the family. So that is commonly observed, and I believe that research also backs that up.
Oh, thank you. That makes sense.
Sure. If I may add something else about this genetic question, as far as I understand and as far as I know about the research and, again, the clinical practice that often we look at these things, is that genes have a potential. In other words, when you have a predisposition for a disorder in terms of your gene, that does not mean that that disposition is going to be actualized. In other words, there are people who have genes, they have the genetic component in their family history for psychiatric disorders, but if the environment and their experience in life kind of doesn't stress them out too much, or somehow it doesn't tap into those genes, they could actually live a very healthy life without those genes being expressed. And vice versa is also true. Even someone who might have you know, very little kind of in their family history expression of such genes, although there might be something there, then if the environment is extremely stressful and those potentials are tapped into, then there could be a possibility of these disorders expressing themselves in that way. So I hope that's helpful.
Thank you. Okay, Erin, do you have any questions you would like to ask?
Sure.
Dr. Kalapur, do you see a combination, or do you feel the combination between traditional Western pharmacological practices and more Eastern holistic treatment methods work well when you're dealing with patients with mental illnesses?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. Yes, I see a lot of utility for using the older culture's wisdom and bring it in. As you know, in the past several decades, there has been a lot of kind of translation of the Eastern mindset from meditation to kind of various aspects of how we can actually use those traditions to deal with stress, with anxiety. And a lot of that has already converged into and integrated into our psychiatric thinking, and our new methods that have been kind of evolved from that. But aside from that, we also see a surge of methods that use somewhat that kind of mindset, but also using findings from neuroscience, findings from kind of using newer methods that use devices. So, for instance, we deal a lot with self-regulation using biofeedback, neurofeedback. That's really a mix of very high-tech kind of state-of-the-art engineering and software and hardware kind of mixed in with some of the methods that have been used for thousands of years in older cultures to really regulate the physiology. So there is a kind of a natural convergence of, if you will, of these kinds of mindsets that now are even finding their way into technology. And we're certainly testing those, using it in certain circumstances, and constantly developing kind of new ways to help people using such methodologies as well.
Great, thank you.
You're very
welcome. Thank you. Dr. Palapur, would you like to continue with your presentation?
Sure, I can speak more, or if there are any questions, I can answer more questions, whichever you prefer.
Why don't you go ahead and finish, and we have a few more additional questions when you're done.
Sure. So, you know, when we are looking at some of the newer methods that are being discovered, or they have been around, but we're basically doing more research with it, what some of the benefits of creating these databases are that we are able to look at, you know, each disorder and how it manifests itself in physiology and in the brain of that particular person. Now, for instance, let's talk about something like ADD, ADHD. So when we map the brain of children or adults with ADD, ADHD, there are, you know, a few different patterns. What we commonly find, for instance, that there is not such efficient functioning of the brain in the frontal lobe. And those dysfunctions or kind of lack of efficiency in functions will affect attention, hyperactivity, impulse control, difficulties with organization and finishing tasks, et cetera, which are, you know, common symptoms that we find with ADHD. Let's say now if we look at someone with, let's say, depression, we find some different brain signature, if you will, kind of a different type of dynamic that we find in the brain. And not only these kinds of patterns are enabling us to diagnose better and kind of understand what's going on at the brain level, but they also guide us for treatment. In other words, there are methods beyond pharmaceuticals. Of course, pharmaceuticals are available, and even at this stage, we are able to guide, to some extent, the choice of medication if medication is really what the patient really requires, or if that's what their preference is, to really guide to some extent the prescription of medication, but also in terms of finding other methods of treatment. For example, we use with several different disorders a method called neurofeedback, which basically helps to retrain certain areas of the brain to either become more active or become less active. So let's say, for example, for someone who has symptoms of ADD or ADHD and there is slowing in the frontal lobe, after the measurements are done and we know where in the brain there is a dysfunction and imbalance, and what the direction is and what the frequencies are, then we can actually devise a treatment plan that addresses specifically those issues, and then those individuals are trained to basically activate that part of the brain gradually by a process of what we call operant conditioning. Same goes for other disorders. We also have done a lot of work with people with brain injury and stroke victims, etc., and also with a lot of people with mood disorders. So similarly, that's what we do. The other thing I wanted to emphasize on is on the fact that, at least from my perspective, the DSM criteria and the diagnostic categories are extremely helpful in some ways, but we're not interested in like just a label. In other words, a lot of times these diagnostic categories become just a label. We have found that really each individual is very unique, and even though for the purpose of communication with other clinicians or with that person, we may need to call it, let's say, bipolar disorder or, brain injury or, anxiety disorder or schizophrenia or whatever. But really each person, aside from a cluster of, symptoms that are commonly found in that particular disorder, they're very unique individuals who might have very particular symptoms that the most other people don't have, or in fact, some of the areas that normally with that disorder is identified, they really don't have that problem. So that's why we find the idea of brain mapping and really these more physiologically based assessments, physiologically based and cognitively based assessments, more useful. In other words, we don't need really that label in that sense. We just need to know what are the underpinning, what are the, brain-related issues, what are the symptoms that are being reported, and what's the best way really to deal with it. And, of course, again, the DSM criteria is very helpful in some other ways, but I think in some ways it can sometimes be very limiting. So any questions or thoughts on that topic, I'll be happy to talk or answer any questions. Hello?
It seems Priya has dropped out, so she's joining in the on the.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah, but the panelists, Jennifer, and any of you want to add to this?
I'm sorry.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. You're on air now. Jennifer and Irene, you're on air.
Oh, can I ask my question now?
Yes,
of course.
Oh, okay. So I just wanted to ask how, if genes influence the type of brain activity that you're studying that is caused or influenced by mental illness. If you're studying a certain type of brain function or brain activity, would that have any be in any way related to specific genes?
There has been, you know, various genes that have been kind of paired with or correlated with certain disorders. But again, I want to emphasize on that doesn't mean that if you have that gene, that for sure you will have XYZ disorder. That those genes are sometimes expressed and sometimes are not expressed. So I don't know if that's what you're asking, or was that another aspect of this question?
Well, I was just wondering what the relationship is between the genes that they're finding that, I guess, raise the probability of a person developing a mental illness and what you're finding in terms of what's going on in the person's brain.
Right. Well, there is definitely the tendency is that for instance, I've seen a lot of brain maps of, you know, family members with similar symptoms, and they're very similar. And we've seen a lot of that happening with ADD, ADHD, anxiety, depression, and a few other disorders we've seen. So oftentimes, if it seems to me, at least, although I'm not an expert in genetics, that if a gene is expressed, of course, it will have its effect on the physiology and, of course, on behavior. And once it has it on the physiology, we see the effect in the brain.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. But I also wanted to emphasize on the fact that, again, I don't believe that if you have certain genes, that's like a sentence that for sure you're going to have that disorder. Again,
right.
Genes are sometimes not expressed, and there is a lot that can be done to really curb that in a different way.
Okay, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Jennifer Robinson, do you have a second question?
Sure. I'm thinking about schizophrenia or schizoaffective disorder, or as far as psychosis goes, I was wondering if you found any effective treatments with the negative symptoms of psychosis, like abolition and apathy and lack of motivation, because I know that those symptoms are sometimes the most debilitating type of psychosis, but they're not always equally remedied with medication. So I was wondering if there was any particular type of therapy or medication that you thought might help with negative symptoms of psychosis.
Right. Well, I think that's a very good question. Currently, I don't work with patients with schizophrenia. In the past, I have. And I have a lot of first-hand experience both with meds and also with kind of various types of therapy. Unfortunately, at least our group has not started doing kind of a brain mapping that we normally do with this population in a systematic way yet. So I really don't have first-hand knowledge of the kind of the brain maps and, you know, how we could be looking at that from a neuropsychological point of view and the brain function point of view.
Okay.
But I think that you're correct about this you know, most of the focus, unfortunately, just because of perhaps practical reasons, has gone to dealing with, let's say, the hallucinations or the psychosis part of it. But there is a lot of, again, depression and other, you know, negative symptoms that they need to be managed. Unfortunately, the problem with these things are often that there is not enough research on the interaction of various medications that are being prescribed. In other words, you know, the common practice is that, well, someone is on XYZ medication, and then if there are some other symptoms, then another medication is tried. But the interaction of these meds together, even two of them, you know, often has never been really researched well in any population. Like, let's say, having someone with schizophrenia on, like, let's say, 3-4 different meds at the same time, and then people respond differently to meds, and they have different kind of profiles, and, you know, it gets very complicated. But the focus, unfortunately, hasn't been on that. I know that certain behavioral methods have been used with some success, but they're limited. I'm not aware of many studies that have been done using other methods, such as retraining the brain or reconditioning the brain. I know there was a few small kind of size research that was being done with the population with some positive effects, but I think we're still at the very beginning of researching this kind of population. And I think hopefully in the future we can expand on that.
Okay, thank
you. In terms
you.
Of these newer methods I'm talking about, yes.
Erin, would you like to ask your second question?
Sure. What do you see as the next big thing on the horizon for the treatment of bipolar disorder?
One of the things I see as a real game changer in psychiatry altogether, but in particular for mood disorders, including bipolar, is exactly what we talked about, is profiling the brain and really understanding, like, for each particular profile. Because, you know, even when you have bipolar, there are so many different variations of that. And obviously, as you may know, many times even on diagnosis, there's disagreement among clinicians. Someone says, oh, this is bipolar. Someone says it isn't. Even though the DSM criteria is quite specific about the symptoms, etc. But there's still kind of a lack of clarity as to, okay, what are the subtypes of it and what part of this is really physiologically based. In other words, we can find brain evidence that, okay, this is a subtype of bipolar, and then what are the different subtypes of that. So I think with the same logic of the type of methodology that was used, we did a very large study on depression, for instance, that looked at the very large cohort internationally, about 2,500 subjects, and see, you know, which profile, which subtype is going to respond to medication X versus the other one, medication Y. And what are the elements that before prescribing that we can actually identify and improve the efficacy and efficiency of treatment response. And I think that's one a very clear area that there's going to be a lot of improvement in the future. But already some of the evidence for that is available, some of the brain maps that are being done can actually shed light on some of the dynamics within that. And then there are other methods that are being used, such as, different types of stimulation of the brain or inhibiting certain parts of the brain, that although they are at their kind of infancy, but there is some promise there. I have seen already some improvement in that area with bipolar patients. In terms of balancing the brain so it's not overactivated and it's not underactivated, because the common issue is that with bipolar, there is that lack of balance that the brain either becomes overactive or underactive in certain areas. So I think we are going to see both in terms of assessment and treatment option kind of suggesting various treatment options, whether it's medication or other types of intervention. And in terms of newer interventions, I think with these new methods of stimulating the brain and being able to inhibit certain parts of the brain, with more research, we're going to see many more options for patients with these disorders.
Okay, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Jennifer, we'll open up the discussion. Callers who have questions for Dr. Phalapur, please press 1 on your keypad and we'll bring you live on air. Callers who have questions for Dr. Phalapur, please press 1 on your keypad and we'll bring you live on air to ask your question. Dr. Phalapur, we have some questions submitted by our participants. Maybe
of course.
We can move on to them.
I'll be happy
yes.
to.
Yeah. There's one person who has asked, what are the developments in the treatment of mental health-related issues in dealing with gun violence?
Okay. I'm sorry, I didn't quite get the question. Could you repeat the question?
Yes. What are the developments in the treatment of mental health-related issues in dealing with gun violence?
Gun violence. Okay. Well, I think when we talk about gang violence, we are talking about not only kind of mental disorder, but also a social problem. You know, that part of it, I'm really not an expert in the kind of psychosocial and the social aspect of it. But from my experience working both in Manhattan, but also having had work in the Bronx and, you know, very different kind of experiences I've had, being exposed to aspects of this, one of the developments that can help is obviously better diagnosis and better assessment of what the problem with, you know, people who are seeking mental health are going to be available. So, for example, you know, right now, the options for kind of treatment, let's say someone has, you know, depression or an impulse control issue or violent behavior, you know, the options are limited. I think that as we're moving towards understanding the brain better, and we have a number of interventions now that teach what we call self-regulation. In other words, it is the ability to regulate one's impulses, and it's the ability to know one's own physiology, one's own impulses, and one's own reactions better, and to have greater control over it. I think with these methodologies, we will be able to really address a lot of the mental health issues that are really beyond some of this. But there's also a part of this that's really a social phenomenon, a social problem that really is beyond my expertise. But I know that as far as the first part that we discussed, there is a lot that's available. I don't know how long it would take before it would become part of the system. Let's say if you have a you know, hospital setting that, you know, is not utilizing these services. Excuse me. I would imagine that within the next 5 to 10 years, some of these methods will be more widely available. And once they are utilized, I think it can be somewhat helpful. I hope that answers the question.
Thank you, Doctor. We have a question coming in from one of our callers. Person calling from 973, please ask your question.
Yeah, hi, Doctor.
Hi.
I'm an employer, and I have a lot of employees, and you know, I mean, the question is, it's not just employer. I mean, you have friends or anybody, you know, who you feel like may have, you know, mental challenges. So, what is the best way to sort of encourage them to seek medical treatment? Because you see some great content about all the mental health challenges, but I think it all starts from, whoever, a friend or family member or employer, to spot this and sort of refer people, because I think that's the most important piece which is still missing. A lot of people probably don't realize that they are suffering from something.
Yes. I think you're asking a very important question. Unfortunately, even though there has been a lot of education about this topic, there is still a lot of stigma around seeking mental health. Meaning that people feel ashamed to be seeking mental health, whereas, there is no difference between having, problem with depression, which is, is a neurotransmitter that's imbalanced in the brain, or parts of the brain that are, they're a neurochemical or electrochemical kind of reaction, and someone who has blood pressure or diabetes. There should be no difference in terms of the level of acceptance or comfort that one gets in terms of getting treatment or wanting to request treatment or suggest treatment. So, for instance, I don't know how many of you or anyone you know has ever heard a friend or family member say, oh, you know what, I have a really good psychiatrist or a shrink, and I recommend them to you. But you might say that with, someone who has a good dentist, for example. So still within our culture, there's a lot of misunderstanding. There's a lot of lack of education. There is a lot of stigma around seeking mental health. I think one of the ways to address that is really psychoeducation, to really teach people and let them understand that there is no difference between this type of illness and someone who has, blood pressure or diabetes or some other issue, and that to actually be open to the possibility of getting help, which is very difficult for a lot of people. And the question you're asking actually is very important, again, for another reason, is that you do want to be very, very careful about suggesting anything like that because, again, by definition, a lot of times when people have experienced a lot of pain and agony with mental disorders, a part of that also makes the person very sensitive and for the right reason. And hearing from someone you need psychiatric treatment is often not welcome. It's something that may be something that's taken as an offensive statement. So I think all you can do is to be tolerant and to make sure they know that you're there if they need help without being too explicit about it. Otherwise, I think you can get yourself into trouble.
Thank you, Doctor.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Dr. Falagura, I have a question for you. How would the federally funded brain mapping project change mental health treatment?
Well, that's another very good question. I really don't know. There's been a lot of discussion about that, even among my colleagues. There are people who say this is great and people who say this is not great because, you know, once this type of science become politicized, then we don't know what the direction is going to be. We don't know who's going to control it. We don't know, you know, again, there are many, many, many questions. However, one thing I do know is that any kind of attention to bring more science, to bring more kind of understanding of the brain, neuroscience, and behavior, psychiatric disorders, we need a lot more than what's being offered right now in order to really get a grasp of, you know, all the different disorders and the number of people who are affected by it and every day suffer because of them. And there are new tools, there are new ways of addressing these. And again, any kind of initiative to really move towards that direction is great, provided that it really stays science and not, so it doesn't become politics. Because that's one way we could actually lose this direction, yes.
Okay. We have a question from one of our participants. He asks, how much of my current adolescent behavior can be explained by a brain virus I had 20 years ago? He is currently 42 years, and he had a severe case of demyelinating viral encephalopathy 22 years ago.
During teenage years?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not sure if I understood the question correctly, but let me try to answer it. Well, you know, any kind of brain disorder or virus that affected the brain can actually affect behavior, can affect emotions, behavior, and can actually change the brain long term. Now, being a teenager itself is quite a challenge to the brain because the brain is rapidly changing, pruning, and rapidly trying to figure out new ways of kind of developing. And, you know, a lot of the frontal lobe is being kind of developed further at that time. And there are many, many changes during that critical period, during the teenage years. So if there was some kind of virus or some kind of brain disorder that occurred around that age, I wouldn't be surprised that the effects are still actually with that person. Having had said that, without doing testing and doing some kind of brain mapping and doing neuropsychological testing and other tests, it's hard to say. But again, it's very likely that the effect can stay long term.
Thank you, Doctor. There's another one. She writes, my parents both have had bipolar disorder. My husband's family has serious undiagnosed mental illness. And they had no idea that they will be passing on these genes from both sides to their children. And they want to know whether some research is being done on this and can the genes be isolated. Couple writes, my children are concerned about passing this on and whether having natural, they want to risk to have natural children. So.
Right, right. Yeah, in terms of, you know, finding out about these genes, obviously is good, but it can also create a lot of anxiety because once we know there are these genes, and if they're on both sides of the family, the chance, of course, increases and all that. I don't know if there is any way yet to address this in any way other than saying that, you know, in my opinion, living a life that as much as you can is a life that can minimize stress is the number one way to really minimize the chance of these genes being expressed. In other words, if the environment is not conducive to these genes being expressed, it could be sparing that generation altogether. But it doesn't mean that even if the environment is stressful, that those kids will have bipolar. It's just that they may have a greater chance. So I think that there is a lot that can be done with education, a lot that can be done with early prevention, with making sure that if there are stressors in their lives, that the kids are in treatment, that they see someone and make sure that early on interventions are done so things don't go out of hand and you don't wait too long to really seek treatment.
Thank you, Doctor.
Sure.
Doctor, you spoke about the research projects that are being undertaken at Brain Resource Center. What has been some of the major limiting factors that you've experienced in the field of research?
Well, in terms of research, I would say the logistics are always difficult. In other words, the logistics of getting people in, for example, right now we're running a few different research projects. One is on anxiety disorder, one is on ADHD, one is mm-hmm. for binge eating disorder, one is on pain disorder. And always the logistics of, orchestrating all of that is quite challenging, but we seem to be actually pretty good at it. The other one is that, that most of the time research funding these days is a problem. And, the type of research we really would like to do is much more difficult to get funding for. So that's another kind of challenge that we face. Other than that, I think that there's a lot of good research that's being done some of it we've done already. Some of the research we're doing now is more geared towards farmer research, which is also very interesting. But there's a lot more that can be done given the right circumstances and the right funding to really push forward some new methodology, which is always a challenge.
Okay. Personalized interventions and tailored process of assessment for diagnosis. That's what Brain Cancer Resource Center's website says. Doctor, how different or how unique is the process of diagnosis at your at Brain Resource Center?
Well, I think that the maybe different components of what we do is being used in other places, but probably the combination of all the assessment modalities, some of which we've been involved in developing, and also some of the interventions we use, that again, some of the interventions we've been involved in developing that kind of intervention. I would say from that point of view, we are quite unique in terms of really having all of that under one roof. But probably bits and pieces of what we do can be found in other places as well, where there's a lot of good research and clinical work is being done.
Thank you, Dr. Falapur. I think we've had a wonderful discussion. Jennifer, would you like to add something?
No, thank you very much for your time.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
Yeah. Dr. Falapur, thank you so very much. It was an honor to have you here today. Jennifer Myers, Robinson, and Erin, thank you so very much.
Kyotok
thanks all its listeners and participants. Thank you for all your support, and we look forward to having all of you join us for the next Cure Panel Talk Show. For more details of upcoming shows, please visit trialx.com/CureTalk. The link for this broadcast will be made available on the Cure Talk website within 24 hours. Thank you so very much. It was great having you all here. Thank you.
Thank you.